Hello and welcome to another episode of Damn Interesting Week. We are so glad you've decided to join us. My name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Waisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And this was a damn interesting week. So let's get started with our first link.
First link.
Okay, from the scientists, we explore how squids camouflage.
Oh, yeah,
they're pretty good at it. And in part, it's because they've got these specialized squid tissues called refractive proteins, aka reflectins. Let's go as far back as in the 1990s, where Margaret McFall Nye at USC, she and her colleague found that E. sclopase forms a symbiotic relationship with luminescent bacteria that live in a specialized reflector organ in the squid's head. A little more than 10 years later from this 1990s discovery, the researchers pinpointed a family of proteins abundantly present in the reflector tissue. And now, detailed characterizations of the protein have shed light on its reflective properties. And bioengineers are taking note, including those from the military, because of course.
Sure.
So, how we got to these reflective proteins? Kind of a happy accident, like most of wonderful science. McFall Nye said, while studying different squid proteins, she and her team noticed a conspicuous polypeptide band on the gel.
So eye-catching.
I mean, if you know what to look for, if your eye has been trained. Now, the researchers isolated the polypeptides from the gel and sequenced them to find an unusual amino acid composition. They largely consisted of relatively rare amino acid residues like tyrosine and tryptophan, but completely lacked common ones like alanine and isoleucine. They're also partially disordered, which means they lack a fixed three-dimensional structure under physiological conditions. Things like pH changes, external stimuli, can actually alter the protein's configuration, which then influences the outflow of water from structures in the reflector tissue. So the team engineered human cells.
There it was.
See,
was
this is what we've been getting.
Yeah. The science is sciencing, let's not forget. And what did they observe when they did this? Well, they could tune the cell's optic properties by tweaking the salt content in the culture medium. So the squid's color-changing system also motivated the team to develop materials with adjustable infrared reflectivity. This is the material that could potentially coat objects and hide them from infrared cameras, which is why the military is like, hello. But yeah, the basic research in the 90s really led to a lot of these current discoveries. And if we can just make life look more like a cool rave, that might be an upgrade.
Well, like, and it means if you go into your bathroom and do like a salt scrub, suddenly your skin changes color. Like, that's fantastic.
And soon it might be even more sparkly, because why not, right?
Yeah. For sure.
All right, next link.
Next link.
So we're going to stay on the theme of sparkly things, because this article comes to us from phys.org. It's titled, Scientists Revive Legendary Golden Sea Silk Using Korean Pen Shell Byssus.
Say what?
Yeah, there's a lot of words in there.
Yeah, I had never even heard of this, but it's like, so this is a luxurious fiber once reserved exclusively for emperors in ancient times, and it's been brought back to life by Korean researchers.
Okay.
There's a photo of it. You can see a bundle of basically silk, except it's pure gold, and it has just like this most beautiful, like it almost looks like water, and it glimmers in that way, and it's entirely gold. Like, it's really incredibly beautiful.
Yeah, like sometimes when they say gold, they just mean yellow, but this is actually shimmery and metallic.
Yeah. I don't believe the silk itself is actually any kind of metal, but
it has
that appearance due to the proteins, but we're going to get into that. So sea silk, often referred to as the golden fiber of the sea, was one of the most prized materials in the ancient Roman period, used exclusively by figures of high authority such as emperors and popes. This precious fiber is made from the byssus threads, B-Y-S-S-U-S, secreted by Pinna nobilis, a large clam native to the Mediterranean, which uses the thread to anchor itself to rocks.
Wait, okay. So like when you're cooking mussels and clams and you have to like pull out their beardy thread things, you're saying that certain species that generate this, we've made silk from it.
I believe so. Yeah.
Nice.
And so it's valued for its iridescent, unfading golden color, lightweight, and exceptional durability. A notable example is the Holy Face of Monopello, a relic preserved for centuries in Italy, which is believed to be made from sea silk. However, due to recent marine pollution and ecological decline, Pinna nobilis is now an endangered species, of course. The European Union has banned its harvesting entirely, making sea silk an artifact of the past, produced only in minuscule quantities by a handful of artisans. Which, honestly, you know, not too different from the past, I guess, really.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I'm surprised, like, billionaires aren't clamoring to wear this stuff themselves.
I know, right?
That you know about. I mean, they're endangered for a reason, right?
Right. They've got the robe in the house. They just don't ever wear it outside.
Yeah. Maybe it smells really fishy?
Could be.
Yeah, it's in a shadow box.
Right.
So the POSTEC research team turned their attention to the pen shell Atrina pectinata, a species cultivated in Korean coastal waters for food. Like Pinna nobilis, this clam secretes byssus threads to anchor itself, and the researchers found that these threads are physically and chemically similar to those of Pinna nobilis. Building on this insight, they succeeded in processing pen shell byssus to recreate sea silk. But their achievement goes beyond mere replication of its appearance. The team also revealed the scientific secret behind the silk's distinctive golden hue and its resistance to fading over time. So the color is not derived from dyes, but from structural coloration, a phenomenon caused by the way light reflects off nanostructures. And they specifically identified that the iridescence arises from a spherical protein structure called photonin, which forms layered arrangements that interact with light to produce the characteristic shine. Another significant aspect of this research is the upcycling of pen shell byssus, previously discarded as waste, into a high-value, sustainable textile.
Like, this creature was useless to us, but now...
Yeah, I mean, it's going the way of the lobster, I guess. Right. So, this not only helps reduce marine waste, but also demonstrates the potential of eco-friendly materials that carry cultural and historical significance.
I mean, it feels a little bit like cubic zirconium in the sense that basically your average person can't tell the difference, but someone's still going to be snooty about it. Be like, I only wear the golden silk from the endangered clams.
Yeah. And I mean, apparently it is the same material. So it would literally just have to be like trying to pretend that I am killing endangered species for my silks. So
You're like, you get it from the ones that we have a lot of, but you're like, please go kill one just in honor of the fact that I've gotten this from this one.
Yeah, sustainability. That's what that
is. Right.
Next link.
This is from New Atlas. Sweating paint keeps buildings cool even in hot and humid cities like Singapore or Houston or now Austin.
I like the examples of cities. In case you're not familiar with cities, here are some.
Here's some sweaty cities for you. Researchers based in the island country found their custom paint, specially developed to sweat, significantly reduced the need for air conditioning while also maintaining its appearance for years.
Wow.
So the major challenge with cooling in humid areas is that water vapor holds on to heat. That means air conditioning systems inside buildings are up against both sensible heat, the temperature, and the latent heat, the moisture from the air, right? It's all that, yeah, but it's a dry heat thing.
Yeah. It's not the heat, it's the humidity, and that is true.
Yeah. So naturally, buildings need all the help they can get to cool down, and that's where this paint comes in. We already have commercial paints with radiative cooling properties that remove heat from surfaces, and we've got solar reflective paint. But this new paint combines radiative cooling, solar reflection, and evaporative cooling to achieve significantly better cooling. The team of material scientists tested their concoction by painting three houses in Singapore, so we need more research, but hey, three is a start. One with bog standard white paint is what they call it, one with commercial radiative cooling paint, and one with a new formula. The research observed that their paint helped reduce the electricity consumed by the home's air conditioning by 30 to 40%.
Wow.
That's because of the evaporative cooling effect, as well as the strong reflective cooling. This paint reflected 88 to 92% of sunlight, thanks to nanoparticles incorporated into the formula for enhanced reflectivity. It's like a mirror.
It's like, yeah, living inside a disco ball that's also a swamp cooler.
Man, this could help make a dent in the high figure that 60% of energy goes into cooling the internal spaces for buildings.
I think if I were going to predict, I would guess that these three houses were the houses that belonged to the research team. And they literally had to draw straws on who got the good paint and who had to be the control. And then they all had to paint their houses and wait.
And what I'm guessing, what my concerns are mold mm-hmm. in the paint, right? Because it's just always trapping in that water.
It traps but releases, though. So maybe it could make some kind of like rain barrel situation, making sure that the paint isn't leaching any chemicals.
Well, that was my other concern. They mentioned nanoparticles.
Yeah.
Nanoparticles probably have a tendency to leak, but I don't know. Maybe not. Maybe they're really affixed in there. And then lastly, is this just going to make the city even more humid?
And bright. Like, that's the other thing. If you've got a house made out of mirrors, right. You're starting fires. Like, right. You're directing light into right. people's eyes. And
I mean,
yeah.
That sucks if you're a humid, but if you're a plant, more light and more moisture is like party mm-hmm. time.
You know, you hit every other building with this, then mm-hmm.
Or you hit, like, just the roof.
Yeah, maybe. We'll see. I'm sure the paint won't be cheap either initially, but over time, those things change. It's just nice. We are trying new things.
And soon you'll have house deodorant. You'll have the whole sweat-based industry.
Next link.
Next link.
All right. Next up, we've got an article from The Guardian talking about South Korea's love bug problem.
Oh.
Unfortunately, this is not a euphemism for anything romantic. It is, in fact, a literal bug that has been swarming the South Korean capital of Seoul for the last few weeks.
Oh, I was thinking like a whole bunch of like little beetles, the Herbie the Love Bug beetles.
No. Oh, the little cars. Beetle. Yeah. The first thing I thought of was the virus, but that's because I'm old. But, you know, there's always a little wiggle room in descriptions like these, because one man's swarm is another man's gentle flock. So there is a video compilation in the article taken by various members of the public if you'd like to judge for yourself. Personally, I'd say, yeah, it's pretty bad over there. There's a few shots of people trying to clear a path through airborne swarms with these little tennis racket things that seem to have been designed for the specific purpose. But the really horrendous footage involves a guy walking out onto what looks like a big expanse of soil and then bending down and shoveling the carpet of bugs away to reveal a wooden deck.
Oh.
Yeah.
I won't be watching that video.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. This is not just like, oh, the swarm of gnats that we get. This is a problem. The good news is the so-called love bugs don't bite, they don't spread disease, and they don't even consume a significant amount of plant matter in their adult form. If anything, they are considered a beneficial species because the adults help with pollination while the larvae growing in the soil help decompose organic matter. Nonetheless, the sheer quantity of them does make them a nuisance, with a recent survey showing that 86% of South Koreans consider them pests, ranking them as the third most unpleasant insect after only cockroaches and bedbugs.
Oh, dang!
Yeah, they're serious. They don't like them. So the formal name of the species is Plesia longiforceps. And they earned the nickname love bugs because they mate midair. So you can very often see two of them clinging together in the throes of passion. Males generally die after 3 to 4 days, but females live for about a week, during which time they will lay hundreds of eggs in the humid summer soil. And they are a very new problem, at least in South Korea. The bugs originally come from the subtropical regions of southeastern China, Taiwan, and Japan's Ryukyu Islands, and were only identified in South Korea for the first time during a major 2022 outbreak. Not surprisingly, experts say that climate change is the primary cause for their recent shift northward, but they also note that the capital city of Seoul in particular has something called an urban heat island effect, which makes it especially tantalizing for the amorous bugs. Basically, the city is just this beacon of heat and humidity that draws them right in, which apparently we're about to make worse with paint. So I don't know that we want to be painting all the buildings and drawing these bugs in. Now, South Korean authorities have released several public service announcements about the ongoing problem, assuring people that, quote, they have a disgusting appearance, but are actually beneficial. And suggesting that if you do want to get rid of them, the best method is to simply hose them off of the surface you want to use. They say you can also try installing light traps and sticky pads around your outdoor lighting or doorways, but they really, really don't want people to spray insecticides because the amount of insecticide it takes to actually get rid of them for more than a few seconds is definitely enough to harm animals and people.
Yeah.
They also mention wearing black clothing as the bugs tend to be drawn toward bright colors, but there's at least one guy in the video wearing all black and he's absolutely covered, so I don't think that one's going to work. The South Korean government optimistically notes that several local species of urban bird have adapted to eating the love bugs this year, and that does seem to be helping in certain areas. And in the longer term, they are researching potential fungal pesticides that could target the love bugs while minimizing damage to other creatures. But that's in the future. Realistically, their best advice is to just wait this one out. The love bug season is intense but relatively short, and they should be pretty much gone by mid-July. So, you know, biblical pestilence, but only for two more weeks, guys.
Right, or put them in a bag and throw them over the fence.
Hey.
Well, you know, they do that with North Korea a lot. They have some of that psychological warfare back
That's
and forth.
That's true. Oh, I don't know. Well, and this could be a problem in North Korea as well. I don't know. They
right,
wouldn't
but
tell
we
us.
Won't know. Yeah. We will never know.
All right. Next link.
Next link.
Okay, we are going to stay with using fungal species for whatever.
Psychological warfare?
I guess. I mean, that's sort of the best description for this Science News article. Zombifying fungi have been infecting insects for 99 million years.
Oh.
So we begin looking at Ophiocordyceps fungi.
Mm-hmm.
Dying fungus-infected ants develop an urge to leave their nest, climb up to a high leaf, and bite down with a death grip. And then in one final gory moment, the fungus explodes out of the ant's back, releasing spores that will infect the next unsuspecting victims. If this sounds a little bit like The Last of Us, yeah, they took their inspiration from this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So finding a fossil of a fungus, it is the proverbial needle in a haystack. But what a stroke of luck that Yuhui Zhuang stumbled across an amber fossil of a fungus-infected ant pupa while digging through his lab's basement at Yunnan University in China.
Huh.
Now, at first, he thought what was sticking out of the ant's back was some kind of developing wing, because some ant queens and males will have wings. But a 3D image of the fossil revealed a fungus sprouting out of one of the antibiotic-producing glands ants have on their back. Now, this fungus was remarkably similar to these modern-day zombie fungi. It had similarly shaped spores. They were growing out of a dome-like structure that had burst from the animal's back. A subsequent search turned up a fungus-infected fly, also trapped in amber, and it too bore same similarities to modern-day Ophiocordyceps. Both of these fossils were 99 million years old.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the oldest fossil ant ever found is 113 million years old. So,
okay.
Zombie fungi might have been infecting the ancestors of ants almost since the origin. Now, ant pupae, they're not mobile. They can't move. So the fungus was probably not manipulating this fossilized ant's behavior in the fossil that kind of kicked all this off. The pupa may have been removed from the nest by an adult worker who was like, yo, infected, get it out of here. And
yeah.
Then once inside, the fungus would have had the chance to release the spores in search of a next victim. So pretty gruesome if you're an ant or a fly or have an eye towards a fairly distant future in which we get caught up in the ruckus.
Yeah, I have a coworker who told me that he had started taking a cordyceps supplement. And I was like, you're just wrong. Like, I'm sure you're taking something, but you've got the name wrong. You are not taking a cordyceps supplement. And he brought the bottle in to prove it to me. He is. And it's not Ophiocordyceps. It's some other cordyceps species. But I'm still like, dude, why are you messing with that? Why? Yeah.
I mean, there are some mycologists who are like, listen, mycology's been messing with us since actually the very beginning of things. The stoned ape hypothesis by Terence McKenna explicitly looks at psychedelic mushrooms as a potential cause for our brains tripling in size during a particular part of evolution. And yeah, if you want to go deeper into mycology, there's a whole rhizomatic world of information there for you. Sorry to mix my metaphors. Okay,
next link.
Next link.
From Vice.com, your intelligence might be determined by a rhythm in your brain.
Huh. Ooh, I hope it's a good one.
It's Samba. I mean, that's my favorite. So. Yeah.
So a study out of Johannes Gutenberg University, Mainz, has found that smarter brains show stronger theta connectivity, a kind of internal brainwave harmony that kicks in when your brain is working hard. Researchers had 148 participants wear EEG caps while completing rule switching tasks that challenged their ability to adapt. The puzzles weren't overly difficult, just stuff like figuring out whether a number is higher than 5 or whether a shape is made of smaller shapes. But difficulty wasn't the point. They're trying to assess how the participants' brains reacted to change and how fast they could pivot when the rules were suddenly shifted. People who scored higher on memory and intelligence tests showed stronger midfrontal theta connectivity when responding to task changes. Or, another way to put this, is their brains locked in. This connection wasn't as strong during cue recognition, meaning being able to see the change coming, but it ramped up during actual responses, suggesting that intelligence isn't about seeing the twist coming from a mile away, but about being adequately prepared for it and nailing it when it arrives.
Hmm.
So, you know, this is a very short, vicey sort of take on this study, but I do think it's interesting to consider the implications of, like, meditation, for instance, and how much that's shown to put you into a theta state and other kinds of, like, brain synchronization patterns. And I kind of wonder if it can go the other direction, too, where, you know, you get smarter through meditation or other sorts of exercises like that, which I feel like there's got to be studies on that already.
Yeah. I mean, it is interesting that, like, so far, most neurological study has sort of separated the human brain because of our ability to predict things, right? We have this ability to create a narrative and see what's coming and put together hypotheticals. And the fact that that actually turns out to not be that useful is really fascinating, that what we really need to be doing is chilling more, not being anxious about what might or might not happen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like that's a life lesson in general.
Easy to do. Just chill out.
Yeah, yeah, man. Yeah. Just chill. It's fine.
Have you tried calming down?
Yeah. Next link.
Next link.
Well, we'll stay on the brain here. This comes from SciPost.org. Exposure to heavy metals is associated with higher likelihood of ADHD diagnosis.
Ah.
All right.
So to counter some of what we had just talked about and why your brain may be playing jazz in your head. Okay, so a study in Spain found that children with higher levels of lead, cadmium, copper, and antimony in their urine had increased odds of being diagnosed with ADHD. I gotta be honest, antimony was a new one for me. Yeah, apparently it's used in a lot of things. We use it actually in black eye makeup for whatever it's worth. So did the goth create the ADHD or the other way around?
I always liked antimony in school because the way I remembered is it looks like the word alimony and the periodic symbol for it is SB, which I remembered as son of a bee for alimony. Like I thought it was
perfect. So, more specifically, higher levels of...
On topic. Yeah.
I love that.
Higher levels of copper and cadmium were associated with more severe inattention symptoms, while higher levels of copper and antimony were linked to greater levels of hyperactivity.
Huh.
So, it's a combo. It's like the Joker and his stuff in the first Batman.
Right.
So globally, around 8% of children and 2.6% of adults are estimated to have ADHD. Boys are more frequently diagnosed than girls. In the U.S., the diagnosis rate among children has risen steadily in recent decades, reaching about 11.4 in 2022. This increase, though, is thought to reflect greater awareness and a broader diagnostic criteria rather than a true rise in the prevalence.
Or all of the extra heavy metals that we have in our environment now that we didn't have 50 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I agree there's a lot of compounding factors, but I also have seen enough children.
Yeah.
Correct. I don't think it's all diagnostic.
Yeah. So for me, this one actually hit home. I am dyslexic and I only found out a couple of years ago that I was gestating, I guess, next to a lead factory.
Wow.
Yeah. And I'm the only one in the family of the three siblings of all of the family that has dyslexia. So, yeah, there may be something to it. But there is a massive knowledge gap. And that's what they were trying to do here regarding the role of heavy metals, right? So they examined 15 different metals. The study participants were 190 children between 6 and 15 residing in the Spanish provinces of Barcelona and Tarragona. Their parents provided early morning fasting urine samples for the study. Among the children, 124 were diagnosed with ADHD and 66 were not, and 131 were boys. They do mention here, the study contributes to the scientific understanding of the environmental factors, just like we were talking about, but I do love this. This is the quote from the end of the article. However, it should be noted that the design of the study does not allow any definitive causal inferences to be derived from the results. So you can ignore the title of the article.
Mm-hmm.
It's not causal yet. We don't have that definitively yet. But again, I think we do.
Yeah. Well, the other thing is there are certain types of I learned a lot about this because I had a friend whose kid was actually exposed to lead through paint in an old house, which he then had to remediate the whole house, which was a nightmare on its own. But they did a urine test on the kid and they were like, oh, he doesn't have elevated levels of lead in his urine, so he's fine. But a different doctor was basically like, well, let's give him one dose of the medicine we would give if he did have lead exposure. And what came out was massive. And they said, yeah, it's stored in there.
Oh,
it's not coming out. Like your body's ability to detoxify that kind of stuff. It does have a certain ability to do that. Otherwise, we'd all be dead. But he was like, you can't necessarily just test the urine and say, well, there's nothing coming out, so there's nothing in there.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, the kid took a couple doses and then the levels went down and he was fine. But it was like, I think there's a whole lot we don't know, not just about how much of this is in our environment, but how much of it is already in our bodies and we don't even know and don't know what to do about it.
Right. So. Like it has to be prompted to be released in some fashion.
Sometimes, yeah.
Mm.
Also, don't lick paint. Like,
yeah.
Don't just stay near a lead factory, you know.
Yeah, Bradley, why did you do that? That was very poor planning on your part.
I don't think any medicine's going to help clear out. I think it's stuck.
If you just try hard enough, maybe you can evolve like a pencil lead coming out of your fingertip and you'll never need to use a pencil again. I choose to look on the bright side.
Yeah, hey, pros and cons, right?
Next link.
Next link.
Okay, this article comes from Science Alert. A strange cellular entity challenges the very definition of life itself. A real easy one to end out on, right? Okay, so they've got a picture of this little dude. It's called a dinoflagellate plankton.
No, it's not.
They called it a dinoflagellate plankton. Like, if I had a choice in naming these, I probably would have gone with it too. I'll be honest, this kind of looks exactly like in Among Us. You know those little avatars where it's like a little Teletubby window with some little feathery bits. It's pretty remarkable. But it is, in fact, a cellular entity they found inside a tiny plankton, living an unexpectedly virus-like existence. And scientists are saying, well, this challenges what it means to be alive. The line between living and inanimate has traditionally and controversially been drawn before viruses. And the newly discovered organism, provisionally named Sukunarchaum mirabili, skates awfully close to that line between living and inanimate. So this little guy only has about 238,000 base pairs of DNA. By contrast, some viruses reach 2.5 million. But like viruses, this entity delegates most of its biological functions, including metabolism, to its host. And also like viruses, most of the cell's genes are dedicated to one thing, replicating itself. Now, viruses, they basically just hijack the host's replication machinery, but this little one's got its own machinery.
I mean, I know a lot of people that need machinery.
Right.
We're just going to keep asking the questions until we come up with better answers, right? But go look this up. Validate my Among Us reference.
Yeah, I mean, the little feathery hat you described, you can buy that in the store if you get enough points. So I think...
I'll play some more Among Us.
That's what it's like the classic, oh, they've sent the video game to the past so that whoever can beat the video game gets to be the warrior in the dystopian future. That's what Among Us is. It's teaching us.
They knew how much we loved Tron, so they're trying to make things easy for us.
Right. All right. Well, that is all we have time for today. We're so glad you've joined us. Some of the articles we did not have time to get to today include The Forgotten Janitor Who Discovered the Logic of the Mind, North Korea to Open Beach Resort as Kim Bets on Tourism, and How a Fake Astronaut fooled the world, broke women's hearts, and landed in jail. So all that and more, plus everything we talked about today, can be found on DamnInteresting.com. If you like our podcast and want to support us, you can do so at patreon.com/DamnInteristingWeek. In the meantime, my name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And we hope you have a damn interesting week. Bye-bye.